I'm Peter Gilchrist, and I'm a food writer.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton, and I am a food historian.
We're on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We're going to be talking to historians, producers, and some all-round great Scots to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're jumping into an era that redefined the very notion of Scottish food.
Kicking off with a focus on a very special time of year.
It's a very Victorian Scottish Christmas. So, I mean, I will say growing up, I have always been objectively in love with Christmas.
I'm also a big Christmas fan.
I think in my family, it was probably around the age of 8, very young, I realised I was the only one in my family with taste.
Oh.
And they will not fight me on that. That is a fact.
Okay.
And it then became about I was in charge of the Christmas tree.
Wow.
I was in charge of decor. As the years progressed, I also became in charge of dessert.
Okay.
And then you side vegetables.
And then you eat your way into
quite literally.
Yeah.
Eat your way through Christmas. And I was also in charge of the TV guide for a while.
Wow.
Because I have, again, very excellent taste at spotting the potential. And for me...
You're a Christmas curator. I love
it. I am. That is a I wish that was a paid job. But for me, I think last year I started to do a bit of the history of Christmas and looking into I had a series called The Origins.
Mm-hmm.
And I think understanding Christmas today and understanding in particular Victorian Christmas, you have to understand the story that came before.
Yep.
Christmas really starts as something called the winter solstice.
Mm.
Essentially, it's the shortest day of the year. And Scotland's ancient people were far more obsessed with the change of season.
Yeah.
Because they were farmers, they were hunter-gatherers. They had to understand when it was time to bring the cows in, when frost was coming. And so things like Samhain, which eventually became Halloween, is far more important in their calendar. But there was a group of people that lived amongst the... We'll talk about... When I talk about ancient people, I'm making sweeping generalisations here. Because there was 9 Celtic tribes, roughly, in Scotland.
Yep.
And then there was also the Gaels that came over in the 5th century. But living amongst them were these group of people called the Druids.
Mm.
And they were essentially, like, the thought leaders. They were the mystics. They were teachers, judges. They made a study of the sun, moon and stars.
Mm.
And... they observed the winter solstice. And they were very secretive. We don't know a lot about them, but we believe that they would go into, on the winter solstice, they would go into the woodland and they would find mistletoe, which did used to grow in Scotland in ample supply. And they would have a ceremonial cutting of the mistletoe. And they would also bring kind of evergreens into their home. It was a part of communing with nature.
I think what's really interesting about the solstice traditions, so the act of sort of that shortest night, sheltering from the winter, but also bringing things inside, making yourself cozy. The way that that lives on in Christmas traditions is really interesting. So you have like the habit of bringing evergreens into your house and decorating with that. I mean, we still decorate with holly and ivy and I mean, the Christmas tree is a much later thing, but it's still sort of feels quite similar. And I really like the way that you can see, particularly in Scottish Christmas traditions, those longer histories have almost, they seem to like cling on a bit more than they do in England, especially with the kind of pagan, the Druids, and also the Viking traditions.
So they arrived sometime around 800 AD, and with them they brought technology, they brought their culture, and they also brought their feasts. And Yule was the kind of the crescendo of the year for them. They would slaughter any animal they could find, cows, horses, they'd have a feast. But the kind of the gem of the Yule feast was a boar's head that would be brought in to the table by the most sort of pure stand-up guy in your Viking community. He was in charge of bringing in this boar's head.
You would have to be very wealthy in Scotland if you were bringing in a big boar's head for your Victorian Christmas dinner.
Mm-hmm.
I've no doubt that some people did it if they could, although, I mean, boar by that point wasn't frolicking in the hills as much as it would have been. But
it's a very rough pig.
Just like a pig that's been like left on the hill
through
for
the
a
middle,
few
years.
Yeah, this poor pig. But no. But in the sort of ways that Scottish people describe their dishes, Yule is often the prefix for a dish that is eaten around Christmas time. So you have Yule Mart, which was, sometimes it's described as an ox. Again, I think historically by the 19th century, it probably wasn't ox that often at all. It was probably cattle. It was probably beef or mutton or sheep. And that was the sort of the animal that was slaughtered for Christmas. And then you have, you know, Yule cake or Yule bread, which was just, for all intents and purposes, a bannock that was baked. And it did have a special sort of cross in it. So that was meant to symbolize the Christian cross, which is an interesting blend of the Viking and the Christian in this oat cake. You would have eaten it in quarters. And then there's other things like the Yule log. Now, when I say Yule log, what pops into your mind?
I think about being in primary school, maybe P4, P5, mm-hmm. and decorating a Swiss roll with a terrible icing, chocolate icing sugar, and a fork and some felty kind of
a fork,
robin.
Yes, because you would use the fork to create the bark-like effect, wouldn't you? Yeah, I mean, we were never a Yule log family. I don't really associate chocolate with Christmas. I'm not really sure why.
What?
Like, eating chocolate, yes, but like not chocolate cake. For the listeners, Peter is looking at me with bewilderment.
I think we had a Sara Lee chocolate gâteau for Christmas dessert.
Really?
From age 0 till I'm 33.
Till now.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is going to make it better or worse. We quite often just don't have dessert on Christmas
absolute
day.
Worse.
Okay.
Absolute
sorry.
Worse.
Like, we always buy like a Christmas pudding and then end up eating it in like August, because by the time we finished, we're all too full. And then you kind of just go into like graze on quality streets and stuff.
Maybe in my adult life now. Although even then, the amount of chocolate you're getting now is hefty diminished. You know what I mean? I think you need a dessert.
I still, yeah. Okay.
Are we something? I'm not saying you need to, you know, break out a Swiss roll and start icing for a 2 p.m. sit down.
Maybe I should have been living back in early prior to the 19th century, because at that point a Yule log was actually a log. It was a bit of wood that you would drag into your house, and you were meant to sort of stick it into the fire the day before Christmas or on Christmas morning, 8-9 a.m. And the idea was it was such a big log that it would burn throughout the whole day.
Mm-hmm.
And that was again something that sort of, whether the tradition was Viking infused or influenced or not, the name for it very much was. And there are other sort of Yule forms of food that are really interesting sort of Christmassy spins on quite traditional Scottish dishes that we will talk about more in our Christmas in the Croft episode.
I mean, I think the thing that's really interesting when I'm sitting here thinking about the word Yule is that it's so ingrained as part of Christmas. Like, it's just another word for Christmas. But when you actually think about it and you think about the belief systems that existed across Europe that had to exist for people to teach people across countries and centuries and continents, that then reaches Scotland. And 1,000 years later, plus, we're still saying Yule.
Yeah.
And we still know about a Yule log that changes, it grows, it evolves, it means something completely different. But it all stems from like folklore.
Yeah.
It all stems from folk belief. And that is what in learning about Christmas and studying Christmas, that's what I think is actually a special side treat.
It is. It's nice. It sort of takes away as well, I think. Sometimes it can be easy now to get overwhelmed with like the consumption that's behind Christmas and the fact that you know, it's driven by all this, you know, it becomes very expensive. It becomes about buying umpteen gifts for people you might not normally want to actually buy gifts for.
Yeah.
So thinking about the roots, those sort of folkloric roots, is actually far more refreshing a take, I think.
I'm laughing because when you said consumption, until the age of about 28, I thought consumption was when someone ate themselves to death. And I was like, why did no one stop?
Oh,
they died of consumption. And for listeners, that doesn't mean they ate themselves to death. It means that there was an illness that consumed their body.
Yes.
And consumption was a word that was kind of, you know, it described how the disease took them.
Yeah.
It did not. had a really good Christmas. And
yeah, first comes the gout and then the consumption, and that's you done.
Right. When you think about Christmas and the way that it existed for people, we have to remember that people were a lot closer to death than they are now. Anyone. They were far more subjected to the cold,
yep.
to famines. Mm. If you're thinking about December in the year zero.
Scary time.
Very scary time. There is nothing to eat in Scotland.
No.
You might be lucky if, you know, you've got some wild kale or some nettles that somehow have survived.
Really, really frozen root vegetables of some kind. Yeah.
You might have some very poisonous berries that will make you very ill. People would gather together.
Mm.
They would light fires to stay warm. They would share what provisions they had. It was about survival.
Yep.
And the Vikings were very much of the same. It had a lot more ceremony for them. Mm. There was a lot more of that community atmosphere. There was a lot more kind of what you may call kind of pomp and circumstance around it. But the people that came along next after the Vikings, or what I'd say the influence for Christmas that came along after the Vikings was the Christians.
Yes.
Now, the Christians had touched down in Scotland some 400 years previous.
Yeah.
But what they had established was the Celtic Church.
Mm.
Now, they were much more comfortable with the fact that everyone was celebrating different gods.
Mm-hmm.
We have polytheism in Scotland where people might have 12 gods that they celebrate, one for nature, one for wind, one for the mountains. There was folklore and things, and it was different all across Scotland. And the Celtic Church just kind of came in and said, that's absolutely fine. We don't have a problem with your gods. Just, also, there's this guy called Jesus.
Can we interest you in him as well?
Yeah, no, and exactly. And it was about kind of drawing people towards themselves. Christianity begins to take over Christmas at the beginning of the 11th century.
Yeah.
There's a couple of big things that happen. One, the first mention of Christmas is noted at 1038 AD. Mm. And that's the beginning of the influence of Christmas starting to come from the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
At the exact same time, we have Queen Margaret, who is essentially adapting the Celtic Church and turning them Catholic.
Mm.
And so with Catholicism comes some really strict rules.
Yep.
We don't want to celebrate your other gods. There's only one. We want you to observe our feast days.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are feast days throughout the calendar. It's not just Christmas. Christmas doesn't really have that like sole importance like it does today.
It's interesting how that's changed, isn't it?
It's one of them.
Sort of secularism now. We've clung on to Christmas, but the rest is kind of...
But back, I mean, Christmas was created by the Catholic Church
really
to copy what was the kind of Saturnalia in Southern Europe, where there was a feast day where they would exchange presents and have a feast and everyone would get together. And it was to celebrate the undying sun in the middle of the winter solstice. And not to talk about etymologically, but a day to celebrate the sun that conquered death is then created, and it's a mass to celebrate Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Christ's mass then begins to spread throughout Europe and then becomes part of how we celebrate in Scotland. And then over the next 500 years, we have this really interesting, a slightly French celebration that begins to spring up as a result of Christmas. For 12 days, there is an abbot of misrule that is put in charge by the royal court in Scotland. And their job every year is essentially to, like, it's like half party planner, half jester.
Is that like you when you were
me.
Little?
This
abbot
is
of misrule.
I feel like if they brought back abbot of misrule, I would kill that role. They were just in charge of fun for 12 days. It was called the daft days in Scotland. And really, it was, of course... We're talking about like Edinburgh and Glasgow. We're talking about areas where the gentry have a bigger impact, where the kind of royals have a bigger impact. We can't say that it was felt the same way in Orkney.
No.
They're far more allegiant to the kind of Viking festivals.
Yeah.
You see that as well across the Highlands and even in the Western Isles where the Vikings had a kind of bigger foothold.
Mm.
That culture remained really strong. And then there's a wee thing called the Reformation.
Ah, yes. That thing.
That thing. Where essentially... people decided that they didn't agree with the Catholic Church. It had gone too far from the Bible. It was engaging in too much paganism, and they wanted to clear the decks. Let's get back to true Bible verses.
Mm.
Now, celebrating birthdays is considered incredibly pagan.
Boring.
Very boring. Pagans have a good time.
Pagans have fun.
The most fun they've ever had. Pagan parties. And also because there is no mandate in the Bible to celebrate the birth of Christ, nor is there really a date that's given for the birth of Christ. And so they decide in Scotland, we're going to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. We are going to make Christmas illegal. So in 1574, a group in Aberdeen were charged with singing filthy carols. And then the year after, an Aberdeen baker was charged and sentenced for filling his home with light and company on a Yule day.
See, I feel very proud to be from the Northeast, having all these partying Aberdonians.
Well, this is it. This is the... that would be St. Andrews.
Oh, wow.
Sorry.
Near enough.
Near enough.
East Coast. It's fine.
But it was really this time where you could not be celebrating Christmas. Now,
imagine that.
The big thing that happened here is it went from a community festival to a small family party where people were still baking Yule bread. Mm-hmm. They were still having Christmas dinner. They were still feasting.
Yep.
They were meeting up where they can, but it became a much smaller insular event. Mm. And that was a big change for Scotland. And it was 300 years before it would be recognised in Scotland as a legal entity of a holiday. When 1958, it was made a public holiday. So, I mean, I think that if you want to take it back, really what the kind of the history of Christmas tells us is that Christmas isn't a day. It was never supposed to be a day. It was supposed to be weeks.
I know. And I wish we still had that.
Lots of it actually is to do with like the Victorian era and the way that it changed work.
Indeed, yeah.
Because if you were a crofter, if you were a farmer, you stopped working in November.
Yeah.
You cannot plough or sow seeds with frost. And so we talk about people didn't have holidays back in the day. They actually were off for about 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
And in the middle of that, they had a big feast where they gathered together. We know far more about seasonal affective disorder now and the fact that people need light and greenery and company to bring them out of a funk. And that is exactly the same for our ancestors here in Scotland.
And I feel like that's the thing. Like, as human beings, we are probably meant to not work, spend time together, have early nights, have feasts, drink. Like, that should be the way that we pass winter. Mm. And we don't anymore. And we try and stay on a summer schedule where we're... And now Christmas is a day. Mm. And I think, you know, Hogmanay, which we'll talk about later, is a day and more so in Scotland. But I still celebrate Twelfth Night. I like extend this as far as I can.
I save my annual leave for Christmas.
Yeah.
I have 3 weeks off and I love it. I love luxuriating in good television.
Yes.
And presents.
And good food.
And good food. And just like, oh, it's dark outside. I'm going to wear my pajamas all day.
Yeah.
That's great. That's what we're supposed to be doing.
Hibernation.
Like our ancestors did. Staying in their pajamas all day, eating
Watching TV
and eating cheese is exactly what they did in 400 AD.
Yeah.
But I think the interesting thing and the reason why I wanted to think about Victorian Christmas is that there's 300 years between the banning of Christmas and it becoming a national holiday. Mm-hmm. And right in the middle of there is the Victorian era, where everything changed. Society changed, the way people work changed, the way that people ate changed drastically.
Yep.
And with that comes this tapestry of people that were celebrating, people that were scared to celebrate, people that were celebrating Hogmanay instead of Christmas, and the way that people like Charles Dickens and Queen Victoria formed an ideal.
Yes.
Much in contrast to the way that we had been celebrating Christmas 200 years before. But it's suddenly something that has stayed with us.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to explore more of.
So in this series, we are focusing on the Victorians in particular. And I think it's important to first sort of clarify what we mean by the Victorian period, because it's not necessarily a fixed point in time. But as the name would suggest, the Victorian period is tied to the reign of Queen Victoria. So Queen Victoria was born in 1819 and she died in 1901 and she became queen in 1837. So up until Queen Elizabeth passed, she was the longest reigning monarch. She reigned for a really long time. And that period between 1837 and 1901 is what we think of as the Victorian period. Now, I tend to look at the longer 19th century because a lot of the things that we think of as Victorian, culturally Victorian, were seeded much earlier, or they were, you know, things weren't that different in 1836.
And when you say the longer 19th century?
So that's kind of a term that historians use. Like, obviously the 19th century was 1800 to 1900. But if you look at the long 19th century, you tend to consider the sort of years just prior and just after as well, for the same kind of reason, in that not everything changes as soon as the century changes. So to kind of divorce time creates these artificial barriers of separation almost, and it can be quite reductive.
That is an amazing phrase.
Thank you. Yes, got my historian hat on, I suppose. So yes, the Victorian period is tied to Victoria's reign. I think like the stuff that we're going to be talking about lasts a bit longer than that. It starts earlier, it ends later, it's going on in between. Mm-hmm. And it's just a really fascinating period, that 19th century period, for a lot of change. And I think, interestingly, from a Christmas perspective, is the fact that Victoria in 1840, so 3 years after she took the throne, married her first cousin, which, very common at the time. We're not going to judge them too much. But she married her first cousin, Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha, and he was from Germany. And as we will discuss in our later episodes, those German influences came to change quite a lot about what we think of Christmas.
Do you think when people were going to the wedding and they were asked, do you want to sit on the bride's side or the groom's side?
Well, I'm the auntie, so I can do both.
I'm the gran.
Right in the middle.
They're both my grandchildren.
They have to walk around me to get down the aisle.
Yeah.
So the Victorian era, the 19th century, was a time of intense change in Britain for numerous reasons. One, our population drastically starts expanding. And because it drastically starts expanding, the population density really changes. So people move away from a far more pastoral life where land wasn't enclosed and you could, like, everyone had the right to land to garner food from. All of a sudden, land starts being enclosed. We have things like the clearances that sort of begin that process. And it's a really interesting time to see how innovations in technology, but also in the way that we worked, in the way that we understood working, living patterns changed. That just drastically changed what life looked like. So you have things like the Industrial Revolution, which is technically pre-Victorian. That means that's the start of innovations like steamships and, you know, all the things that we think of as kind of integral to our daily life.
The railway.
Yeah. Indoor heating, plumbing, all this stuff is sort of happening in the Victorian period at various points. Towards the end, you have like the beginnings of electrification that are starting to happen and like actually coming into people's houses. And it's just a time. I think I'm fascinated by the Victorian period because so much changed so quickly that in all the writing of the period, you can sense this kind of effort, this attempt to grapple with that change. It was like the rug had been pulled out from under us. You know, we as Scotland and Britain in the sort of early part of the 19th century, early first half of the 19th century, were the head of a global empire. You know, we were the global stronghold. The innovations that happen across the 19th century very much accelerate the speed at which we can get goods from around the world to Britain. The fact that our population is expanding so quickly also means we can't feed everyone anymore. This is a big issue. People are moving more into city centres because they're being pushed off of land, and also industrialism and industrialization and mechanization around things like cotton means that factories are being set up in urban hubs, and that's where work was. So you have cities rapidly expanding, and all of a sudden the way that people interacted with food drastically changed, because usually you would have your own, you would have a kale yard, or you would have a cow or a sheep or a pig or a goat. You would have chickens. You would have the means of feeding yourself. And that is not to say that it was some pastoral idyll, because it's very easy to, and a lot of Victorians actually do write about those early days as like the golden days, forgetting that there was massive famine and just, you know, it wasn't actually all that great.
Had four children, one lived. Yay for us.
Yeah, just it's grim times unless you were very, very wealthy, basically. But what's interesting about this period in time is for the first time in Britain, the distance between food producer and food consumer vastly widens. So instead of butchering your own meat, you go to a butcher's to buy it. Instead of growing your own vegetables, you're buying them in. Things like innovations in food technology are changing the way foods are actually preserved. Are, you know, instead of preserving your own food, you might buy a tin of food. I mean, this is all stretched out at various different points over a very busy 100 years. But the Victorian period is, the other thing that's very interesting from a food perspective is the invention of steam, the steam print press and stereotype printing meant that writing and became far more available. So writing and books and reading, which used to be the sort of preserve of the upper classes, all of a sudden literacy really starts increasing. And with stereotype printing, it became quite cheap to produce things like newspapers and pamphlets and magazines. So then writing is more widely available, which means things like recipes are more widely available. So you have this, for the first time, this kind of sense that, oh, the recipes I'm reading here are not necessarily the preserves of the upper classes. It's not a cookbook who's written by the lady of a grand house up in Sutherland. Actually, it can be something that's far more, you know, far more available. And it's the first time you can actually kind of trace that tangibly. So yeah, very rich period. It's also the period where instead of refilling things like bottles and, you know, we start throwing away food packaging, things get produced on almost a mass market scale. So for the first time, you can buy a tin of branded biscuits and give it to someone as a present. So we have the kind of beginnings of marketing and advertising that we now very much just assume as the norm. That really began in the Victorian period as well, which I think is especially interesting when we consider Christmas, because the kind of commercial cookie tin Christmas that we all now think of with a Christmas tree, with a turkey, that was all born of the Victorian period.
Yeah. And I think as well, when you're thinking about the way that print exploded, there was suddenly this aspect of morality and taste
that
was combined for the first time, where if you were suddenly encouraged to emulate a queen in a palace.
Yes.
And a king that brought his tree over from Germany.
And wasn't it pretty with all the candles all over it?
Wasn't it pretty? Yeah. And there's a sense of morality that people, you can be a good person if you buy the right things, if you imbue the right attitudes, if you can set the right table, then you are the angel of the house.
Oh, the angel of the house, yeah.
You are a top-tier human being if you can serve the right side dishes.
And if you don't, and we're talking particularly about women here.
Almost exclusively
about women. If you don't do these things, then it is your fault. Not only that your life might be a mess, because why would your husband come home if you don't have the perfect dinner on the table? All these self-help books, these cookbook tracks, these treatises, they are, it's not, the act of cooking dinner is not the act of cooking dinner. The act of cooking dinner is to ensure that your husband doesn't go out gambling and spending all your money. It's ensuring that he comes home and wants to come home. But that's not just a personal thing. That's the good of society resting on your shoulders. If that's not being done by the dinner that's on the table, how can Great Britain flourish? It's just a lot of responsibility.
And the other thing that is put on women is about children. Childhood becomes something that is to be valued during the Victorian era. We start to see legislation that comes in that talk about children need education. They shouldn't be worked so hard in a factory. It's still worked to an extent.
Give them a wee break sometimes.
But give them a wee break, put them to school for half the week and then everything's fine. But also Queen Victoria and her picture surrounded by her 9 healthy children. Not one of them had passed away. This was because she made the right choices.
Yes.
And this is about what suddenly is confronted with the housewife, and especially around Christmas, is you need to make the right choices to provide a childhood, to provide healthy care, to feed your family, or you might as well throw yourself off London Bridge.
And, you know, let's talk about one of the big men of the Victorian period and Christmas to this day, Dickens.
Like, yeah.
A Christmas Carol is not a very happy tale.
No.
It's about suffering. It's about when people didn't manage to serve the right Christmas dinner, essentially.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of our Christmas iconography still comes from. So there's a hefty dose of guilt that comes along with food in the Victorian period.
And A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens was a massive seller in Scotland.
Yep.
To the point where he came up and did book tours and readings of A Christmas Carol in Edinburgh and Glasgow and further north. And people were really gripped by this story of the man who is faced with his morality. He needs to start being charitable.
Yep.
He needs to see that there's something beyond money for himself. 100 years previous, the only people that were expected to be charitable at Christmas were big houses.
Mm.
It was about people that had acres of land that were keeping a household running. They were seen as if you need to give a big old, you know, public gift to a charity or to your local poor people, your local widows and orphans.
Or if you had servants, you would give them their Yule, which would be like whiskey and a bit of bread.
Yeah.
And that's you done.
Yeah. We're always fed this kind of visual of the Victorian era, and I think especially around Victorian Christmas, of London. And we are shown this, like, this idea of the Victorian kind of townhouse and the kind of billowing garlands.
Yeah.
But everything is focused around London. And if you're got a really creative BBC budget, maybe you do something in Manchester or Liverpool.
Yeah.
But I have never really seen someone look at Victorian Christmas in Scotland.
No.
And part of that, I mean, the way you were talking about the Victorian era is so broad. But actually, my dad's granddad was a farmer on Islay who only spoke Gaelic.
Mm.
And then the next year, he moved to Paisley to be a ploughman.
Wow.
And within the space of a generation, not even a generation, the space of a year, he went from having sheep and grain, and he didn't work for 4 months of the year, to then working in a factory in Paisley, getting up to start work at 8 o'clock, not being in charge of his holidays, not being in charge of what he ate, how he ate.
Mm.
His wife had also grown up in Islay. They moved together.
Mm-hmm.
She was suddenly to balance a book and a budget and cook food that she wasn't preparing herself, that she was having to buy in from these places. And how you then approach this kind of big Christmas dinner, I think, is a fascinating look.
Ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, let's go. Always exciting. So inside we have the hat.
You have the hat. What I've prepared for you today is a Victorian joke came inside a cracker. And a Victorianism of the day, and you have to guess what it means.
Okay. So, I'll read the joke first. Why is a Christmas pudding like the Atlantic Ocean?
I don't know. Why is a Christmas pudding like the Atlantic Ocean?
Because it's full of currents.
Oh.
What a shame we don't have a snare drum nearby. And Victorianism of the day is nanty-narking.
So what do you think that means?
I have two guesses. The first one is just general tomfoolery and like jigging around. The second one is telling on someone, like tattling, like being a clipe.
Being a narc.
Yeah, being a narc. But I feel like that's an Americanism. I'm not actually sure.
Well, I don't think so.
Mm.
Because narking is being annoying.
Ah.
Narking is being irritating.
Right.
And narking is an irritating thing. So I think that might be the etymology, if you want,
of narc.
Of being a narc.
Yeah.
And nanty is about being happy. So it's about if you're nanty narking, you're being so happy you're annoying and irritating. You're being too out of control with your joy.
Are you trying to tell me something that you're by
nanty,
giving me?
You're a big old nanty narc.
Lindsay, you're nanty narking me right now.
I think we should bring this back.
Yeah.
And also, I think what we might find out is that all Victorianisms sound incredibly dirty in 2024.
I mean, yeah, it could very easily be panty narking, which would be something completely
different.
Being
a panty
different.
To an annoying degree. Join us next week for a look at Scotland's rural Yule with our all-new episode, Christmas in the Croft.
This podcast was hosted by Peter Gilchrist and Dr. Lindsay Middleton. The sound engineer was Curtis Campbell at Studio 23. This episode was produced by Tenement Kitchen. To find out more information, please email hello@tenementkitchen.com.